First case for argument is Wellpoint v. Commissioner of Internal Revenue, Mr. Cook.
Good morning, Your Honors. Philip Cook for Wellpoint, the appellant. May it please the Court. The tax court's decision below should be reversed because the origin of the claim was directly connected to the manner in which the taxpayer conducted its for-profit business. The tax court's decision is very strange on this critical point.
No, they stripped you of your equitable title, right?
That was the outcome of the litigation, Your Honor, but it was not the origin of the claim.
That was the going-in intention.
I'm sorry, sir?
That was the intention going in, was to strip you of your equitable title to these assets.
Well, I don't think that's a fair characterization of the charitable trust lawsuits. The nature of a CyPray proceeding.
What do you think? It's not CyPray. That's not correct. What is it that you think the object of the lawsuits were?
The object of the lawsuits was to enforce a dedicated use of the property. The complaint sought
raw remedies. In other words, you have the legal title, having acquired these charitable assets, but you don't have the equitable title. You're not allowed to use them except to provide the, you know, charity services.
The lawsuit sought to ensure the assets were used in accordance with a dedicated use. There were broad prayers
but look,
for
you
relief.
You don't understand. You have been stripped of the, well, you've lost them completely, but the object was to strip you of the equitable title, of the control of these assets.
The object could have been a consent decree that we manage the assets and affirm our nonprofit status. That could have been a perfectly acceptable
settlement. And that would just sterilize your ownership completely. You'd just be a trustee, not managing it for your own welfare, but for other people.
The assets, since the entities were formed, had been used to provide health insurance.
Did the underlying disputes relate to specific identifiable assets or simply to the corporation's profits generally?
It related to the gross assets of the companies. In the case of the Ohio complaint, it related to the gross assets of the hospital insurance division of the company as opposed to the medical insurance division. The attorneys general objected to the manner in which that insurance business was being conducted. They believed that it had been conducted appropriately as a nonprofit activity up to the time that Anthem had control of management. After Anthem had control of management,
But you have no interest in running a charity, right? That's why you don't have it anymore. You don't want to run this thing.
We had an interest in running.
You're interested in making profits. You're not interested in having a nonprofit insurance company.
At the time, we were a mutual insurance company. We were running it for the benefit of our policyholders.
Why has it all been stripped away from you?
Well,
you don't have any of these assets anymore, right?
That's not right. We have paid a settlement for a small fraction of the assets. But the lawsuits were for the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan in these particular states for all of their assets. We paid a tiny fraction of those assets to settle the lawsuit in each state. Prior to the acquisition, we had mutual insurance companies operating for the benefit of their policyholders. After the acquisition, we had mutual insurance companies operating for the benefit of their policyholders. This wasn't a stock-based company after the acquisition. The claim was, though, that we had a profit orientation, and in fact, Anthem was notorious mainly for disclaiming any obligation to be a nonprofit. Anthem viewed itself as for-profit, building the reserves for the benefit of the policyholders. Obviously, down the road, Anthem had a public offering, and the policyholders in these three states participated in it. But the specific objection was you had this local entity that was being nice and was purporting to be nonprofit, but it was a mutual insurance company. Then it was managed by an out-of-state entity that wasn't playing nice and was purporting to be a profit-making entity for the benefit of the policyholders, but there was no change in who was going to benefit from it.
Is there any scenario under which you could deduct the settlement costs if we agreed with the tax courts that the lawsuits did indeed arise as a title contest to alleged charitable assets?
Well, the tax court said that they are to be, the payments are to be capitalized to all the remaining assets in each of the three companies. That essentially leaves us with an amortization claim over the future for the additional basis. But it really just sets up the next potential dispute. I mean, there will be issues as to where that basis gets allocated, what the recovery period is. There's no question ultimately there will be recovery of that basis under the tax court's decision, but it's a messy situation. The whole, as this court said in Illinois Tool, the purpose of the origin of the claim test is to help us make this capital asset versus current period determination. That's why, for example, this court in Clark Oil said, yes, maybe ordinarily a lawsuit for nuisance produces damages that can be deducted, but if you look at the substance of the current dispute, it was a dispute about the process of acquisition.
See, that's why your reference to the fact that you settled for a tiny fraction is irrelevant, because it doesn't matter the outcome of the suit. It's the object. So their object was to strip you of control of the assets. Then you fight back and you don't lose all the assets. You give up $100-odd million. But what they'd wanted at the maximum was that you would give up all these assets and they'd be put into some charitable trust, and it would be like taking your headquarters away from you.
With all due respect, I don't think the attorneys general or bounty hunters out hunting for assets for new charities. I think what they wanted was to assure that the assets were used the way they'd historically been used.
What if you had an office building and the government came along and said, oh, by the way, this office building, because of some historical zoning rule or something, this office building can only be used as a nursery. And so now the building is completely worthless to you. Now, would that not be a situation in which they were taking away your title in a meaningful sense?
Well, that implicates two authorities out there. There's a revenue ruling where the quarry was faced with a town ordinance that they couldn't use it as a quarry. And the service ruled, well, that's an attack on the use of the business tied to the profit-making business, and therefore, under origin of the claim, is deductible. That revenue ruling cited in the briefs. Compare that to, I have an office building, and they bring a condemnation action because they want the building.
There are tax court cases which say that if a building is rezoned to make its original use foreclose its original use, that loss of the value of the building has to be capitalized.
Well, I would compare it to a case.
And I don't know if you know these cases. Galt versus Commissioner.
Which case, Your Honor?
Galt. Galt versus Commissioner. Anyway, there are these zoning cases.
The tax court in BHA looked at a situation where the broadcaster was operating in ways that the FCC said that doesn't comply with our rules, so we're going to pull back your license. The IRS said that's the expense of that fight has to be capitalized because it's to protect your license. The tax court said no. This is a fight that had its origins in whether or not you're complying with their rules.
Now, that's a special thing. Broadcast licenses, they can't be property, right?
Well, they're intangible assets.
They can't be property. That's a, you know, FCC. That's basic to the FCC. Can't be property because the FCC reserves the right always to yank your broadcast license. You don't...
The contrast is between...
I don't see the difference between taking away your legal title to these, you know, insurance policies, whatever they are, and saying you can't make any money out of them. What's the difference?
We could operate... They wanted to assure that the business was operated the way it had been operated. It had made plenty of money previously. And the purpose of the lawsuit was to focus on the conduct and the way the business was operated. That could have been resolved with a consent decree, and it was not, it didn't have a purpose to take our property.
If you look at the Connecticut and Kentucky complaints, they're perfectly explicit. They want you to give up these assets. Right? They say that. It's the relief sought. It's not true with the Ohio one, but it's true with the others.
They also object to the way we're using the assets, and they recite that we were using them properly in prior periods. So that the objection was to the way we were using the assets.
I think everyone is using CPRE wrong, but what they ask for is enter an order CPRE, the defense convey the trust assets to a charitable organization. Well, I couldn't be clearer, could it? What they're after? Didn't get it all, but that's what they wanted.
It was not the conduct that gave rise to the suit.
They wanted to take your property away. What does it matter what their motive was?
Because the origin of the claim says you look at what were the facts from which the lawsuit stemmed. It stemmed from the way we were running the business.
Order that Anthem divest itself of the corpus of the trust and place it with Kentucky and entities operating in accord with a charitable intent, etc. I mean, what's they wanted to take away your assets.
The law is quite clear that the outcome is not determinative.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cook. Mr. Catterall?
May it please the Court. My name is Arthur Catterall. I'm an attorney with the Justice Department, representing the commissioner in this appeal. I'd like to address a couple of points raised in the appellant's reply brief. One of the alternative arguments that the commissioner made below was that these settlement payments were neither capital expenditures nor deductible expenses. The tax court concluded they were capital expenditures, and we continued to assert our alternative theory. Is that an
alternative ground for affirmance, or are you asking for some different relief?
It's an alternative ground for affirmance.
And it would have the identical tax consequences as?
At issue, yes.
What about other years?
Other years, it would not be binding on other years because it was not necessary to the tax court's judgment. It was not necessary to the decision that the tax court rendered.
But if we agreed with your alternative ground, would that have any implications for other future tax years involving
No.
these same assets? No.
Is just as the government is would not be the government is not prevented as things stand now, the government is not prevented from renewing its alternative argument with respect to future years. And by the same token, if this court were to affirm based on our alternative ground, the appellants would not be stopped in future years from attacking that theory again.
I don't understand. If we upheld it?
It's just an alternative ground.
It doesn't enlarge the government's rights?
I'm sorry?
It doesn't enlarge the government's rights?
No, because, I mean, in effect, the tax court's conclusion that these settlement payments were capital expenditures, in effect, is dicta. It was not necessary.
Well, look, I don't understand. Alternative holdings are treated as holdings. They have precedential effect.
Well,
we said, you know, that we agreed with your alternative. First of all, if we agreed with your alternative ground and not your primary ground, that would be the only holding. But suppose we agreed with both. Well, that would be a precedent for your future quarrels with this taxpayer.
Again, because the only issue that's necessary to the judgment that the tax court rendered is whether these payments are deductible or not. We've offered three alternative grounds for saying that they're not deductible, and that's all we're, you know, it's an alternative. This theory that they're neither deductible nor capitalizable, it's just an alternative ground. And again, it doesn't enlarge anybody's rights. It doesn't impinge on anybody's rights. It's just an alternative ground for finding that these settlement payments were not deductible. That's the only point I'm trying to make, is that the appellant says we should have cross-appealed, and I'm saying that we couldn't have cross-appealed because we wouldn't have had standing, because we're not harmed by...
I misunderstood your ground. I thought that what the tax court says, where they have to amortize this, you know, and when they deduct little pieces of it every year, no?
No, I mean, the tax court, all the tax court had before it were the years 1999 and 2000, and whether these settlement payments were deductible or not. The effect...
But I thought the question, they're deductible over time, aren't they? I mean, they're a capital expenditure. You're allowed to deduct.
If they are capital expenditures, but the court...
You say they're not capital. You say they're nothing. They have no tax consequence, which implies they can never deduct any part of the 100-odd million.
Right.
But I thought the tax court says they can deduct it. It just has to be over the, you know, life of the assets.
If you look at the opinion, I don't think the tax court ever said, here's the consequences of our finding that...
But if they're capital expenditures, right.
It's in the conclusion.
What I'm saying is that conclusion was not necessary. The court did not need to make that conclusion.
That's the whole theory of the tax court.
Right.
That this is capital. It's not ordinary business.
The question that the tax court was faced with was, are these deductible expenditures or not?
Look, because the tax court's holding allows WellPoint to capitalize the settlement costs, it seemed to me, you know, reading through the briefs, that accepting your disgorgement argument would indeed enlarge the judgment in your favor.
I don't believe so, because I don't think it's binding in future disputes. It's just an alternative ground.
Anything we say is going to have an effect.
Well, again, in my mind, the issue is whether this was necessary to the tax court's judgment, this issue of whether it's capital or not capital.
Well, but it's there. I mean, whether it's necessary or not, that's what, you know, that's what's handed to all of us here, and that's what we have to deal with, don't we?
I don't think so, because that has no effect on the years before the court.
All wet. So move on to something else.
Okay. The next point I wanted to address in the reply brief, we have indicated in our brief that the standard of review is clearly erroneous. We continue to maintain that. In their reply brief, the appellants cite the Staley case in support of the idea that this is standard of review is not clearly erroneous. Staley really was not even an origin of the claim case. I mean, this involved.
How does clearly erroneous get in? There are no facts in issue. Clearly erroneous about review of fact findings. What are the fact findings here?
The determination of whether of what the origin of a claim is. I mean, I think every court that's looked at this says this is.
Look at these. You look at the complaints, right? What's the fact? What's the dispute
well,
about?
Well, I think courts have said, you know, you look at all the facts and circumstances.
What are the facts besides these complaints? What are the facts? The whole point of the origin of the claim doctrine is we're not supposed to look at what happened. We just look at what the claim was. Where's the room for disagreement as to what the claim? I don't understand.
Well, I think, you know, whenever you've got an inherently, I mean, courts are always saying this is a facts and circumstances test.
Look, what does facts and circumstances mean concretely in the context of this case? You have a complaint. And so the question is, were they challenging, do these complaints challenge the ownership of these assets by the company, or are they just...
For instance, in Clark Oil, if you just looked at the complaint, you'd say this is a nuisance action. So this is...
All right, so what do you want us to look at here besides the complaint?
I think it's the complaint. I mean, most of the facts are going to be in the complaint.
Well, what are you talking about Clark Oil then? Clark Oil, you say, well, if you just look at the complaint, you'd miss something. Well, what do you miss when you look at the complaints here?
Well, to the extent... I mean, you know, hopefully the complaints have...
Well, what are you talking about? Why'd you bring up Clark Oil?
Because in Clark Oil,
you said that was a case where there was material outside the complaint that was germane. But there is no material in this case, right? Or is there?
I think the complaints largely cover...
What do you mean largely? What's left over?
There's a long, you know, history of all these various entities. I don't know if the complaints are...
So what's the relevance of the history of these entities?
The relevance is that way back when these entities were...
What does it matter if it was way back when or 2 minutes ago?
Well, again, I'm looking at the general case law takes a facts and circumstances approach.
But if there are no facts and circumstances, what's the relevance of that general case law?
If there are no facts and circumstances outside the complaints, then the complaints are what you go by.
Are you arguing that the settlement payments were incurred by WellPoint to change its corporate structure for the benefit of future operations from a nonprofit to a for-profit entity? Because if so, your argument, well, I'll ask you, is your argument undercut by the temporal gap between the time WellPoint merged with Blue Cross Blue Shield, those entities, and the time the lawsuits were actually filed?
I don't believe so. I mean, there is somewhat of a gap. I don't think it's a I mean, we're talking, you know, a year or two or three. I don't think the fact that there's a little bit of a gap between the mergers and the instigation of the lawsuits undercuts our argument. And in terms of...
Well, do you know why the various states brought suit when they did? Because even before the mergers of the Blue Cross Blue Shield entities... they were operating in such a way that, you know, these claims could have been brought, right?
No, because before the mergers, even though these entities had mutualized, they explicitly reaffirmed in their bylaws, organizational documents, that they are committed to nonprofit status, and you know, there's no private inurement, and that's what went away when these the mergers occurred. And as far as you know,
Ohio. So the Ohio complaints wants just a declaration that the defendants are required to hold these assets as a fiduciary. Now, so they don't want to take them away and put the assets in another entity. Why is that a quarrel about title?
I think the Ohio complaint is a little bit special because it was a procedural mechanism to the claim had been asserted a year or two before the complaint was filed. There were all these negotiations and a settlement was reached. The only reason the complaint was filed was a procedural mechanism to get an agreed judgment from the court. So the Ohio complaint is a little bit bare bones in that respect, and is not going to be as helpful as the other complaints as far as factual information. But when we're talking about what did the claims arise out of, I think the point is that the claims did not arise because of what these Anthem entities did. These claims arose because of what they were. They were for-profit entities. I mean, these claims arose because of the language in their organizational documents. So it's not a question of...
What if they'd said that because they'd acquired these nonprofits assets, they could have them, they could make money. The only thing they could do is they couldn't give bonuses to the employees.
If that was the settlement, or I'm sorry,
well, that's what they wanted. They say, if you buy the assets of a nonprofit, you can do with them what you want, except you can't pay bonuses to the employees.
I think that's clearly a different case because that's not saying give us the assets back or give the assets to a charity.
Ohio isn't saying giving the assets back; it just says operated them.
And that's one reason that I think you have to look beyond the complaint in Ohio.
We didn't have to look beyond the complaint.
Sorry?
You said we didn't have to look beyond the complaint.
You said you didn't have to look beyond the complaint.
You agreed.
Well, I much more agree in the case of the other two states. The Ohio complaint.
But why isn't – I would think you'd have a cleaner position if you just argued that what – Ohio wants to do, like the other two states, they want to strip the equitable title from WellPoint. That's their challenge.
That's one of our.
They're content to have WellPoint have the, or at least Ohio is to have the legal title, but it can't use these assets except.
The problem with that is that these are for-profit entities. They can't operate as charities. With their organizing documents, articles of incorporation, what have you, would not allow that kind of relief. And so that's why, as you say, this is an attempt to.
Can a corporation? Corporations have they control pension trusts for their employees, right?
And I think that's a little different than running a charity for the public welfare, as opposed to your employees.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Catterall. So, Mr. Cook, how much time does he have? 2 minutes. You have anything?
I ran over. I reapproach with some trepidation, but let me simply restate a point. If you look at the complaints, there are quarrels with how Anthem was running the business. Look at the Kentucky complaint. They have all this objection to Accordia, the affiliate, doing transactions with it. There's lots of objections to how they were running the business. What the origin of the claim says is we don't worry about the outcome. We worry about what were the facts from which the lawsuit stemmed. Here, the lawsuit stemmed from the way Anthem was running the businesses after the mergers. And I understand that we've had a dialogue on that, so I don't wish to pursue it further. It was issues like bonuses or policyholder dividends that were at stake. I mean, the mutual insurance company under a code is not nonprofit or for-profit under these states. It's just a mutual insurance company run for the benefit of the policyholders. And so we do believe that the other cases could have been settled with consent decrees, and that means that what the issue was not conveyance of assets, but how do you run the business? And under origin of the claim analysis, if it's connected to your business, then it ought to be ordinary. I think
that what's the $113 million or whatever it was? What's that about?
What?
What is this $100 million that you gave up?
It was cash to settle the claims.
Well, why would their concern about how you were running your business generate more than $100 million in damages?
Generate more than $100 million.
What would the basis of that be?
Resolving the dispute, getting on with our business. It enabled us to...
What did they claim that you were doing wrong that justified or that induced you to make that settlement?
It varied in minor ways from state to state. The most outspoken thing is that Anthem disclaimed the duty to operate on a nonprofit basis. It said we can set up ancillary businesses. We can do business with them. We can set up health insurance brokerage.
Why would that give rise to $100 million in damages? Isn't it true that the $100 million is a portion of the assets that you acquired? You're giving up a chunk of those assets. It's not that you caused damages to anybody. Right?
The settlement agreement said we are paying these monies.
You wanted your assets, and then you settled. You didn't have to give them up all. But did they ever allege that you had caused some harm to anybody that would justify a damages award?
The harm was in the operation. For example, in the Kentucky complaint, the Accordia, the transactions with Accordia were said to harm the Kentucky plan, to harm the public interest.
How could it harm the public interest?
It could harm the public interest because theoretically it could have been used for some alternative public purpose.
Theoretically. Well, theoretically doesn't create damages.
The damages were negotiated as an amount to let us carry on our business.
There were no damages. This is just a chunk of assets you gave up.
And for the purpose of allowing us to continue our business.
Of course. But you didn't. It wasn't damages because you were using the assets in a way that it hurt somebody.
I would suggest to the court and your honors that the origin of the claim was not a process of acquisition, but was the conduct that we were engaged in. The resolution of the claim was to allow us to get on with our business, and those are classically connected.
It could be enjoined, but it can't be damages when there's no harm.
We could have been enjoined. And the case law says you don't look at the outcome. You look at the underlying facts that caused the litigation.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. Move to our second.